All right, we're in Numbers chapter 8 is where we actually are. Last week, I feel bad because the guy who asked the question isn't here. Dave Henserling will have to listen to the recording because he's not here this morning. But he asked a question last week. We in chapter 8, verses 1 through 4, there is these words are said. Now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to Aaron and say to him, when you set up the lamps, the seven lamps that shall give light in front of the lampstand." And Aaron did so. He set up its lamps in front of the lampstand as the Lord commanded Moses. This was the workmanship of the lampstand, hammered work of gold from its base to its flowers. It was hammered work according to the pattern that the Lord had shown Moses. So he made the lampstand. The question was asked last week, is there a correlation or is there some kind of relationship between this lampstand and the lampstand, seven lamps in Revelation chapter 1? So let's real quick go to Revelation chapter 1 and look at the lamps that are talked about there, and then we will spend some time answering that question. But rather than just answer the question, I'm actually going to walk through some basic Bible interpretation and try to help us understand it so that we can all understand together. In Revelation chapter 1, starting at verse 12, is when we have the lampstands introduced in Revelation. And it says, "Then I turned to see the voice that was speaking to me, and I saw seven golden lampstands. In the midst of the lampstands, one like the Son of Man, clothed with a long robe and with golden sash around his chest." And he goes on to describe who it was. And he really describes Jesus, who's talking to him. And so we don't have to wonder about what those lampstands symbolize. We don't have to wonder, what did those lampstands stand for? Because in chapter 1, verse 20, he tells us exactly what the lampstands are. He says, "As for the mystery of the seven stars you saw in the right hand, and the seven golden lampstands, the seven stars are the angels of the seven churches, and the seven lampstands are the seven churches." Okay, so that is the two seven lampstands that are being compared. Is there then a correlation between the two? Is there some significance there? It seems there is, right? I mean, you have seven lamps and seven lamps. Those must be the same thing. Same exact words. If you look at the Greek Septuagint and you read seven lampstands in Numbers chapter 8, you read the Greek New Testament, you see the same exact words, seven lampstands in both translations, in both places. So that must be the same thing, right? Wrong. Wrong. It's not a good thing to say that because somebody in Scripture something is described this way or said this, then the next time you see it or every time you see it throughout the Bible, it is the same thing. I'll give you two examples of why that's a problem. In Revelation chapter 5 and following, you have the seven seals are being opened. The first seal that's opened is a rider on what color of a horse? What color of a horse? A white horse. Okay, a white horse. The rider on the white horse who brings and speaks peace, and that white horse is speaking peace is a description of the Antichrist and what he is doing. If you read what's happening there, it's the false peace treaty that's issued between the Antichrist and Israel that really establishes or sets up the beginning of the tribulation. That's Revelation 5, right on white horse. When you get to Revelation 19, you see somebody else coming on a white horse. Who is coming on a white horse in Revelation 19? Jesus. Real problem if you say right on white horse is always the Antichrist. Real problem with that. So it's not. All right, so if I was to ask you who is the bride of Christ or what is the bride of Christ, what would you say? You would say the church. And most of the time you'd be right. Most of the time, you'd be right. Throughout the New Testament, the church is referred to as the bride of Christ. Ephesians chapter 5 clearly indicates the church is the bride of Christ. That's absolutely true. Until you get to Revelation chapter 20. Revelation 20, you see something coming down from heaven, something called the bride of Christ. What is that thing coming down called the bride of Christ in Revelation 20? It's the New Jerusalem. So you'd have a real struggle, and trust me, this is something I actually did struggle with as I was teaching through Revelation. It's like, How is it threatened to set my theology up on its end until I recognize, no, what he's doing, it's a comparison. Revelation 16 is the city of Babylon. Revelation 20 is the city of the New Jerusalem. And rather than being a harlot in Babylon, it's the bride in Revelation 20, New Jerusalem. So it's wrong. It would be a bad idea to say that the bride is, because the bride, church is called the bride in Ephesians, that always then, every time you see the word bride, it's talking about the church. That would be a bad thing to do. Well, I think it's equally wrong necessary to say that then, well, that it says seven lamps here in Numbers, and it's the exact same seven lamps in Revelation. Why would you do that in the first place? Well, you do that if you want to replace Israel with the church. That's a really good way to do that. It's a really good vehicle to replace Israel with the church, because after all, you've got the seven lamps that are designed here for Israel, and then the church is referred to as the seven lamps that are the seven churches. Sure feels like it's the same thing, and maybe what has happened there is that the work of the Israel has transferred to the church, and the church has now become the seven lamps. That's if you want to see them as the same thing. So I don't believe they're the same thing at all. I don't believe they're the same seven lampstands. Okay, I don't think that. Why don't I think that? Because the overwhelming, abundant teaching of Scripture is that God is not done with Israel, that God promised to send Israel into captivity, but he promised to restore Israel to better than they'd ever been. Someday I would like you to read Zechariah. Zechariah is a letter written, or a prophet prophesying after the captivity. And he prophesies yet a future time of restoration when Israel, the nation Israel, the one he is prophesying to, will be established in such a way that it will be this great nation. And Israel itself looked forward to that kingdom. All the way through first century Israel, Israel looked forward to that kingdom. And the disciples looked forward to that kingdom. And Jesus looked forward to that kingdom, because when the disciples asked Jesus, "Are you going to set up your kingdom now?" Jesus didn't say, "No, not a kingdom, kids. You're done. I'm done with you. You don't get to have a kingdom anymore." But he says, "Of that time and of that hour, no one knows except the Father in heaven." And it's not for you to know when that starts, but the indication is it is someday going to start. Why is that? Because he says, when you see these things happening, it means it's going to start. Okay, so he doesn't indicate that it's not going to start. So I believe that, so because of that, I have a hard time saying that the seven is the same thing. So what is then the significance? How are they related to each other? Are they related to each other? I would say absolutely. As I began to, I answered last week, I do think that the lampstands are related to each other or correlated to each other, but they're not the same thing. So what did the lamp in the tabernacle do? What was their primary function? The primary function of the lamp in the tabernacle was to give light to the holy place. That's what it was there for. It was to give light to the holy place so that the priest, when he went into the holy place, remember how the tabernacle is designed. The tabernacle is designed with three major areas. Actually, we could go with four major areas for the tabernacle. The first major area of the tabernacle is that's outside. The outside of the tabernacle, outside the wall where anybody could be. Then you have the second major area of the tabernacle. The second is the courtyard of the tabernacle. In the courtyard of the tabernacle, which would eventually become the courtyard of the temple as well, in the courtyard of the tabernacle, you have limited access. You have only Jews could go in there, and only Jews who were not unclean. Only clean Jews could go in there. And I'm not talking about those who had just taken a bath. Those who were ritually clean, could go into that place. So that's the second. In that place, there was the laver, where the priests would do their ceremonial washings, and there was the brazen altar, the altar of bronze that was there in that section. Once you got past that, there was the third major section of the tabernacle. The third major section of the tabernacle is called the holy place. In the holy place, on every day except the Day of Atonement, in the holy place, there were three pieces of furniture. Three things that were daily attended to. There was the lampstand, with the seven lamps, which was described for us in Exodus chapter 25. It was completed in Exodus 37, and it's talked about here again in Numbers chapter 8. That's the lampstand that was, and its primary function was to give light so that the priests, when they went in, could do the job that they were supposed to do. That's what it was there for. Second, the second piece of furniture in that in the holy place was the table of showbread. Table of showbread was, there were 12 of these loaves of bread that were changed out daily. They represented the presence of God with his people. They're actually called the bread of presence is what it's actually called. Some translations still call it showbread. A better translation is bread of the presence of God. It represented God's presence with his people. That's what it represented. And then at the back of that area, as you walked in, the very back, just right before the veil, there was a thing called the altar of incense. The altar of incense was a special recipe for the incense that's given back in Exodus. They would make that, and there would be that they would burn that incense on that altar that represented the prayers of the people. That's significant because it is that altar that Zechariah in Luke, when Zechariah goes in, it's that altar that he's tending to and he's responded to. And Gabriel says, "The Lord has heard your prayer." As he's tending to the altar of incense. That's on every day except the Day of Atonement. If you read Leviticus 16, it clearly shows to me that on the Day of Atonement, that altar of incense was placed inside the veil. Inside the veil. Why do I say that? Because if you read the description of the Day of Atonement, the high priest would go inside the veil, and there he would offer incense on the fire that was burning continually before the Lord. So it had to have moved inside because he went inside the veil, and there he offered the incense, and then he sprinkled on the mercy seat inside the veil. So that's only one day a year. Only one day a year it was set up that way. How'd they get it in there? Remember the tabernacle was mobile. They could take it down, tear it up, take it down, tear it up. And so I think it was easy to understand how that could happen. How that would take place. I'm not going to describe that. I'm not going to debate that. But I think a clear reading of Leviticus chapter 16 and Hebrews chapter 9, you have to draw that conclusion. You absolutely have to draw that conclusion because I'm confident the author of Hebrews did not get it wrong. I'm confident he got it right in Hebrews 9. So anyway, we're going to move forward. And if that just made you, what is he talking about? Read Hebrews 9, read Leviticus 16. I'm just encouraging you to do that. I know I'm talking fast, but I want to get through this. So you have that's what's going on. So what was the function of the lamp stand? The function of the lampstand was to give light so that the priest could do his job. That's what the function of the lampstand was. So what does the lampstand represent? Light. Right? It represents light. We have stories of the lampstand. We have the lampstand was supposed to be continually kept full of oil, continually burning so that there would always be light in there. There's the story of in the intertestamental period, there is the story of Antiochus Epiphanes, who basically took the temple over for himself for a while and prohibited all kinds of sacrifice. He actually sacrificed a pig in the Holy of Holies. He sacrificed a pig there, supposedly set up an altar to himself there. There was a guy named Judas Maccabeus, Judas the Hammer. He actually led a revolt, and they took that temple area back from Antiochus Epiphanes. But Antiochus Epiphanes cut off the oil supply for the lampstand. They had no oil for that, and so the oil supply was cut off for 8 days. They couldn't get any oil into the lamp for 8 days. Yet, the tradition is, the legend is that the lamp kept burning without any oil added to it. The lamp kept burning for those 8 days. What feast do we get from that? Hanukkah, okay. Purim is. Somebody said Purim. Purim is the feast of Esther. The feast of Esther after when Esther and what's his name, Mordecai, when they eradicated those against, they cast Purim to figure out what day they were going to do. That's Purim. That's associated with Esther. Hanukkah is associated with intertestamental, the Maccabees. Those are the two feasts. The two feasts that Jesus kept are Purim, that aren't Old Testament feasts, that are not established in the Old Testament, are Hanukkah and Purim. Those are the two feasts. And we're going to talk about Hanukkah. I'm doing this for a purpose. We're going to talk about Hanukkah in just a second. So you have that going on, and it really, I think that the indication or the symbolism for the lampstand for Israel is the light of God's presence with His people. The light of God's presence with His people, okay, represented in, you know, really in Christ, in Jesus. That's what's there. Okay, so that's the Old Testament lampstand. What about the New Testament lampstand? Well, the only place we have it ever referred to as lampstands is in Revelation. It's in Revelation. So let's ask ourselves a question. Does Jesus Himself attach Himself to the lampstand in the temple? Does He attach Himself to that lampstand, somehow saying, this lampstand and I are one, kind of a thing? The answer to that is, well, yes and no. And I'll do the no first, okay? Because the no is the one that probably you're thinking about. The no is the one that probably you think, oh, yes, He did. Oh, yes, He did. Okay, so Jesus, in John chapter 8, verse 12, Jesus stands up and says to the people, I am the light of the world, right? And He's standing at the temple. He's at the temple. And He says, I am the light of the world. But I don't think He's talking about that lampstand. Why is that? Well, because if you start off in context, in John chapter 7, the context puts what is just happening is the Feast of Booths is just coming to an end. The Feast of Tabernacles, Feast of Booths, read it, John 7, that is the feast that is just coming to an end. The candle, I keep calling it the candlestick, the lampstand in the temple had nothing to do with the Feast of Booths. So why would Jesus then use that feast or the end of that feast to say to the people, I'm the light of the world? Well, here's what happened. Tradition tells us that when the Feast of Booths started, they put up four huge menorah, four huge lampstands around the temple. They were huge, tall lampstands. And those lamps burned 24 hours a day throughout the Feast of Booths. At the end of the Feast of Booths, those lamps were extinguished and taken down. It is at the end of the Feast of Booths, as those lamps are being extinguished and taken down, that Jesus says, I am the light of the world. And who walks in me will not walk in darkness. So it's just getting really dark because these huge lampstands are going out, and Jesus says, I'm the light of the world. So He has not associated Himself at that point with the feast with Hanukkah at that point. He's not associated Himself with that candlestick. He's associated Himself with those four big menorah that were taken down at the end of the Feast of Booths. So that's the no. When he makes his light of the world statement, he is not at all identifying Himself with that candlestick in the temple. I don't believe. That's the wrong symbol. That's completely the wrong symbol. So then does He ever identify Himself with the, well, we'll get to John 10. In John chapter 10, you have, and this is why it's really important to know what feasts are being talked about here. In John chapter 10, we come to the end of the Feast of Dedication, and it's winter. Okay? Where do you find the Feast of Dedication talked about in Exodus or Leviticus or Numbers? Where do you find the Feast of Dedication talked about? And how did that go? You know, Ron Thompson stood up here for nearly two solid hours and talked about the feast, not really, it was a long time, and talked about the Feast of the Jews, right? Where is the Feast of Dedication in Exodus, Numbers, or Leviticus? Where is that Feast of Dedication found? It's not. It's not, because it is Hanukkah. The Feast of Dedication is Hanukkah. It is the only winter feast that Israel celebrates. It's the only winter feast Israel celebrates. So at the end of the Feast of Dedication, the eight-day celebration of Hanukkah, is when Jesus gets up and says, I am the Good Shepherd. and my sheep hear my voice, and they know me. So there is an attachment to that lampstand, but it has nothing to do with lamp. It has everything to do with presence. It has nothing to do with light, but everything to do with presence. If you read what he says about in that section there in John chapter 10, regarding what he said about after the Feast of Dedication. Feast of Dedication is Hanukkah. So yes, Jesus does identify himself in a sense with that candlestick, or I keep calling it that. Candlestick is really a bad word, because candlestick didn't even come into being until, you know, the Middle Ages. Lampstand is the right word. He identifies himself with that lampstand, but not necessarily in the production of light, but rather in the emphasis of presence. Okay, so that is. Are there other places where Jesus is identified as light? Yeah, John chapter 1. Jesus, you know, in him was light, and life, and the light was the light of men. There clearly is indication where Jesus is identified as light, generally. But is there a place where Jesus identifies himself as or with that lampstand? I don't think you find it. So then what is the correlation? Well, I think what do you find when you find Jesus in Revelation chapter 1 and the statement about the lampstands? Let's go back there. Because I think here's the correlation. And Dave, you walked in late. I started this before you got here. You missed the first part. Listen to it online if you want to. You don't have to, though. It's free stuff. So what is being talked about when we get to Revelation chapter 1? Well, we first see it in chapter 1, verse 12, where, so let's build that context for us as well. What's going on? John is on the island of Patmos. He's been there for a while due to the fact that he's been preaching the gospel. Because he's been proclaiming the gospel, he's been exiled to the Isle of Patmos. And on the Lord's Day, he is out. He's praying on the Lord's Day. One Lord's Day, we don't know which Lord's Day it is, but it's one of the Lord's Days, one of the Sundays that he's there on the island of Patmos. As he's walking, he turns, he hears a voice, and he turns around to see that voice in verse 12. Then I turned to see the voice that was speaking to me, and on turning, I saw seven golden lampstands, and in the midst of the lampstands, one like a son of man. So when he turns around, he sees seven golden lampstands. Was Jesus the lampstands? No, can't be Jesus being the lampstands, because Jesus isn't the lampstand. Jesus is in the midst of the lampstands. So walking among those lampstands is one like the Son of Man. And he's clothed with a long robe and a golden sash around his chest, hairs red like wool. His eyes were like a flame of fire. His feet were like burnished bronze, refined in the furnace. His voice was like the roar of many waters. And in his right hand he held seven stars. From his mouth came a two-edged sword. His face was like the sun shining in full strength. So John sees him and falls at his face. And we would have a question, what is the lampstands? What do those lampstands represent? What does that mean? What are they for? Is that the same lampstand? And we know it's not, because the lampstands are defined for us. They're described for us. They're actually told us what they are. The lampstands are the seven churches. Could the lampstand in the tabernacle be the seven churches or represent the seven churches? Survey says no, because the seven churches were not even in existence at that point. It can't be a reference to the seven churches. So what then is the correlation? Because I do believe there's a correlation. The correlation is, I believe, it is the symbolic of the presence of God with his people to help them accomplish the ministry they're supposed to accomplish. What comes next in the book of Revelation? Seven letters to seven churches, right? And in those letters to the churches, Jesus says, I have, for most cases, and he says, I commend you for this, but I got a problem with this. Actually, I said in most cases. In two cases, he doesn't commend for anything. And in two cases, he doesn't say, I have a problem with anything. So, but the general way he attack or not attacks, approaches them is, I like what you're doing here. I commend you for this. But I have this against you. And then he calls them to a response. He calls them to a response. So the significance there, I believe, is the lampstands represent the presence of Jesus with his people to help them accomplish the purpose they've been set forth to do. It's interesting. There was one priesthood in Israel, the Levitical priesthood. The lampstand was designed to help them accomplish their purpose. We, as the church, have been established as a kingdom of priests with a purpose to accomplish, and the light of Jesus is there to help us accomplish the purpose that he set up for us to accomplish as well. So there, I believe, is the correlation. There's the correlation. You're very, very, very funny. So the answer is yes, but not nearly probably what you expected. It's not yes because it's the same lamps. It's not yes because somehow this lampstand then transferred to the church. I don't think that's the case at all. I don't think it's yes because this lampstand said, I believe that this lamp, the lampstand in Numbers is the lampstand for Israel, and that lampstand will be reestablished in the temple. When the temple's rebuilt, it will be reestablished even in the millennial kingdom. This lampstand will be established and burning, so it can't have been replaced with something else. Can't have been replaced with something else. So that's, yeah, Dave Barry.
As I understand, you said that there was menorah in the Holy of Holies.
Holy place. No, the menorah. Good question. On the Day of Atonement, if you read Leviticus 16 and Hebrews chapter 9, you got to read those two together. On the Day of Atonement, it appears that the altar of incense was behind the veil. The altar of incense was behind the veil. Well, let's just do it. I'm going to Hebrews 9 first. Hebrews 9 first. And the reason I get here is because as I was teaching Hebrews on Thursday morning, I came to chapter 9. And what I don't ever do when I'm reading something, when I'm teaching something, I try not to ever just blow it off. Not that big of a deal. It is a big deal because it appears as you're reading Hebrews chapter 9 that the author gets it wrong. It appears he gets it wrong because of how he says the furniture was distributed in the tabernacle. Chapter 9, verses 1 through 5. 1 through 5, yeah. Now, even the first covenant had regulations for worship in an earthly place of holiness, for a tent was prepared for the first section, in which were the lampstand and the table of bread of presence. It is called the holy place. Okay? Behind the second curtain is the second section called the most holy place, having the golden altar of incense and the Ark of the Covenant covered on all sides with gold, which was, and he goes on to describe it. So, and clearly what he's talking about, as you read the rest of chapter 9, he is talking about a Day of Atonement sacrifice, a Day of Atonement approach to God. On that day, the Day of Atonement, he describes the furnishings this way. In the holy place, there was the candle, there was the lampstand, and there was a table of showbread. That was in the holy place. In the most holy place, or the Holy of Holies, there was the altar of incense and the mercy seat, Ark of the Covenant mercy seat. That's how he describes it. So does he get it wrong? Because as you read the description of the tabernacle and where the furniture is to be placed, it is clear that the altar of incense was on the outside of the Holy of Holies. It was in the holy place. Until you get to Leviticus 16. Leviticus 16, let's just go there real quick. Leviticus 16 is where the Day of Atonement is being described and how the Day of Atonement works. We'll start at verse 6. We'll start at verse 11. I want to go to 11. Aaron shall present the bull as a sin offering for himself and shall make atonement for himself and for his house. He shall kill the bull as a sin offering. He shall take a censer full of coals from the fire from the altar before the Lord and two handfuls of sweet incense beaten small. He shall bring the inside the veil and put the incense on the fire before the Lord, that the cloud of incense may cover the mercy seat that is over the testimony, so that he does not die. Where does that fire come from that he puts the incense on? That's the altar of incense. Where is that altar of incense on the Day of Atonement? It's inside the veil. It is inside the veil. Why is that special? Well, I think it's important. I think it's significant because that is the one day a year when the high priest is the one who offered the altar, the incense on that altar, directly representing the people of God to God and his very presence. In his very presence. Every other day, the one who took care of the altar of incense was just a regular priest. On the Day of Atonement, the one who offered incense was the high priest, doing it inside the veil as a celebration of the Day of Atonement. Again, you've got to read Leviticus 16 and Hebrews chapter 9 together. As you do that, though, I think the clear picture is on the Day of Atonement. On the Day of Atonement, the tabernacle was set up this way. In the courtyard, you had the bronze altar and the laver. The laver on the courtyard. As you walked in the holy place, you had the lampstand and the table of showbread. And as you got beyond the veil, you had the altar of incense and the Ark of the Covenant and mercy seat. That's how I think it was. That's how Scripture describes it being situated on the Day of Atonement. Every other day, you, on the outside in the courtyard, you had altar, laver, holy place, you had lampstand, altar of incense, table of showbread, beyond the veil, mercy seat, Ark of the Covenant, mercy seat. That's every other day. But the Day of Atonement, it feels like, it seems different. Hang on, Mike was first. Yeah. Absolutely. Exactly. Most days, nothing went on inside the veil, except the presence of God dwelling on the mercy seat as a pillar of cloud or pillar of fire. It was there. And I think that's where the light came from. That's where the light came from. All right? The Day of Atonement, they're the same thing, except now the high priest actually got to see the light. Other day, you didn't see it. He was actually working. Yeah, exactly. Accomplishing his purpose, the presence of God. All right, I think Dave Barry was, and then I'll get Brian. Okay, I'm done.
Maybe it's a simple. How did the altar of incense get there? The only one could enter was the high priest, so I assume he had to take that with him, along with the other items.
So that's, once the temple is established, once the temple, a permanent place, is established, I'm probably with you on that one. I'm not sure how that happened. Remember, as the Ark of the Covenant, the tabernacle. The tabernacle was a tent and could be taken down and put back up, right? Could be taken down and put back up. How do they know they're supposed to take it down? Whenever the pillar of cloud or pillar of fire went away, they knew, we're going to get ready to move. Take her down, right? So I'm confident that probably what happened was before the Day of Atonement, presence left, Levites went in, took down the veil, moved the ark, moved the altar of incense, put the veil back up, and got out of there. That's the way it was designed. It was designed to be taken down and moved around, right? So it was taken down regularly, and the furniture was put back in regularly. So on that day, when you put the furniture back in, you didn't put the furniture back in, you put the altar of incense behind the veil, and then you got out of there. Because as soon as the presence of God hit again, you didn't want to go in that place. You did not want to go in that place. But it was immobile. It was a tent. So I think during the wandering years, that's how it happened. When the temple is established as a fixed, solid place, I would probably lean toward the high priest had to move it in there. Or, you know, I don't know. So that's the best answer I can give you is mobile while it was a tabernacle. When it became permanent, I don't know. So, okay. Dave Hinserling? No, Brian Ballman. That was you. That was not Dave Hinserling. Sorry, I lied, Dave. Scared him. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yep, absolutely. Absolutely. That's exactly my point. It represented, on most days, it was the prayers of the people. That day, it was the prayer of the people for God to atone for their sin, God to accept this covering. We focus on what the high priest is doing. What were the people doing on the Day of Atonement? I think they were outside and they were praying, they were beseeching God to accept this sacrifice on their behalf by this high priest. That's what they were praying for. And it's significant that on that day, the altar of incense was there directly before the mercy seat. And those prayers were directly before the presence of God. I think that's significant. Anyhow, that's long answer to a really, really short question, but there you go. My hope was that you'd get the fact that, yes, I see a correlation. The correlation between the lampstands is the lampstand in the tabernacle was designed to provide light for the Levites, the priests, to accomplish the purpose, to accomplish the ministry that was set before them. The light of the church, the lampstand of the church, is the same exact thing. It's Jesus' presence providing us the light to accomplish the tasks he set before us. That's the correlation. But I wanted you to see how I get there, not just there's the answer. So I hope that helped. I hope that was fun. It was fun for me. It was fun to do that study for me. It was fun to go through that. You probably are asleep. I'm pumped up here. You're probably, that's fine. Steve?
Yeah, this is not in support of what you're saying, but kind of off the path. So, going back to Revelation, sorry, it dawned on me. The seven churches, are we not, all of us not direct descendants of one of those churches? How else can we work against that? If we had to come from one of those churches, would that be a true statement?
No.
Sorry, it's kind of awful.
No, that's not a true statement. That is not true. We are not, I would safely say we are all descended from the Church of Jerusalem. I'll give you that one. But that's as far as I'll go. Because once the church starts moving out to Antioch and Samaria and other places, we have no clue. We can't track our lineage back to one of those churches. And the seven churches are the seven specific churches in Asia Minor that Jesus is going to give this message to. So, yeah. So I would also attach significance to the seven, not necessarily because it has to do with this lampstand back in that's the next step, not necessarily because it has back to do with the lampstand in the tabernacle, but because Jesus is going to talk to seven churches in Revelation, and seven churches are going to have seven lampstands. That's the point there. So that is the second differentiating thing that differentiates it from that other lampstand, the lampstand in Numbers. All right? So, this is why it takes us 14 years to get through a book. But it was fun. Like I said, I had a blast. I had a blast doing that. So that's that. Moving forward now. I have 5 minutes. Yep, I have 5 minutes. So we can go to Passover, chapter 9. We talked about the Levitical stuff last week. I kind of had like 3 minutes, and so I did that last week. So the Levites, we talked about last week. Chapter 9, we have verses 1 through 14, we have the Passover celebrated. And this would be the first month of the second year. So this is the first Passover outside of Egypt. So Passover happened in Egypt when they left. They've come out of the land. They've been there a year. And now they hit Passover. And the Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai the first month of the second year after they had come out of the land of Egypt, saying, "Let the people of Israel keep the Passover at this appointed time. 14th day of the month, twilight, you shall keep it as appointed time according to statutes, such rules, you shall keep it." I think it's interesting that what happened, what was the first Passover all about? Wow, it's been a long time since Exodus. That was clear back in Exodus chapter 12. I can't remember that. We've done Leviticus and Numbers. It's been 3 years-ish. Deliverance. What were they to be ready to do when Passover was done? Do you remember that? They were to be ready to go. They were to be ready to go. They were actually supposed to eat their Passover meal with their sandals on, with their cloaks on, dressed and ready to hit the road, hightail it out of there. It wasn't going to be have a big meal, have a nice food, go take a nap. That wasn't it at all. You were supposed to eat and be ready to leave. It's interesting. In the years since they've left, they've gotten the law, they've built the tabernacle, they've done all this stuff. What are they getting ready to do? They're getting ready to go. I don't think it's insignificant that Passover is here to say, get ready to go. How are you supposed to eat Passover? With your sandals on and with your cloaks, so you're ready to go. And I think that the reason Passover falls here, the reason Passover instructions are given, is God is saying, get ready. Get ready. I think that the people of Israel have done well in getting ready. Remember the list of gifts that have been given back in chapter 7, where they came, each, 12 tribal leaders came and gave this incredible gift. And at the end of the incredible gift giving, God speaks to Moses. Moses hears God speak. And I don't think it was a Charlton Heston kind of, thank you, Moses. I don't think it's it. I think when God speaks to his people, usually it's in a still, small voice. I think that's probably what Moses heard, was a still, small voice, the whisper, as God speaks to him. And then we have the priests getting reestablished, what they're supposed to do. We have that happening. And now God says, celebrate Passover. Why? Because you're getting ready to go, kids. This is almost over. You're about to head toward the promised land. Imagine the anticipation. Imagine the eagerness. Imagine eating this Passover this time with the anticipation that is, we might be leaving soon. I mean, That's eager anticipation. So he tells them, keep the Passover. Keep the Passover. So he says for most every Israel, they're supposed to eat the Passover. But there's a problem. There's a problem. In their doing everyday life and doing everyday things, some of them had become unclean. Some of them had become unclean. Look at verse 6. There were certain men who were unclean through the touching of a dead body, so they could not keep the Passover in that day. They came before Moses and Aaron and said, those men said to him, we are unclean through touching a dead body. Why are we kept from bringing the Lord's offering at its appointed time among the people of Israel? And Moses said, wait, that I may hear from the Lord what the Lord command concerning you. And this is what the Lord said. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, to speak to the people of Israel, saying, if any one of you or your descendants is unclean through touching a dead body on its long journey, or is on a long journey, he shall keep Passover to the Lord in the second month on the 14th day at twilight. They shall keep it. They shall eat it with unleavened bread with bitter herbs. So there is a second Passover day given, second opportunity for Passover. When is it? When is it? You do the math and tell me, when is the second Passover? When was the first Passover? Okay, just read it. When was the first Passover? First month, the 14th day of the month. When was the second Passover? Second month, 14th day. So exactly a month later, if you were unclean, so here's the deal. If you were unclean for two specific reasons given, touching a dead body or you're on a long journey. Those are the two specific reasons given. I don't know that this is expandable. If you're unclean for some other reason, it doesn't appear you fit in this group. Because God himself specifies if you're unclean for one of these two reasons, either you've touched a dead body or you've been on a long journey, then you can wait a month and do Passover on that day. Do Passover that day. I was trying to read through some Jewish stuff regarding Passover, and I don't think that happens today. I don't think there's anybody who does a second Passover. There's no indication that I know of that it's celebrated as a second Passover on the second month, 14th day. I don't know that that happens. But there was a prescription for it, an opportunity for it to happen here for that group of people. So that's the second Passover that was given to them. Mylene. I'm saying that there were two Passovers scheduled. There was the Passover that was the national Passover, first day, 14th month. And for those, by direct word of the Lord to Moses, for those who were unclean because they touched a dead body or they were on a long journey, for those people, there was a second Passover scheduled on day 14 of month 2. Okay? That seems to be the case. That is all of the significance I'm attaching to that is for those people who are unclean, they got a second day. And all the reading I did, I couldn't find any place where they actually still do that. There's one Passover day, seems to be first month, 14th day. That's what it seems to be. So I'm sure if Ron were here, he would add something to that. Praise the Lord, Ron is... No, that's not true. We can actually be done halfway on time. It's past time, so thank you. You listened really well. I hope it was helpful to you. Let me pray. Lord, thank you for your word and your truth. Help us have wisdom as we understand you through your word. Thank you for opportunity to hear from you, from the message this morning. Help us to be worshipers in truth and spirit. We ask this in your name. Amen. Thanks. You did a good job.